Hello and welcome to the Dancecast, where I explore dance as an art form, traveling to non-traditional places and with non-traditional doers. I'm your host and my name is Silva Lakkonen. It's episode 30 on Dancecast. In my last episode, I talked to Twain in Tampa, Florida, who is the founder of Revolutions Dance. And he was keeping mentioning a lot this name, Marilyn. Marilyn and I know or have met each other a couple of times before, so I was happy to have the opportunity to invite Marilyn Morris to be my next guest at the Dancecast. I knew that she had designed a dancing wheelchair, so she will talk more about that in this episode as well. She's quite a remarkable woman and has done so many things and is really pushing also the dance and disability and the opportunities for people with disabilities to get into a college at her own college at the South Florida, University of South Florida. But let me introduce Marilyn Morris to you. She's the assistant director for the dance program at the University of South Florida and a full-time faculty member invested in teaching and research. She holds a Master of Fine Arts degree in dance performance and choreography for Florida State University and a PhD in dance studies from Texas Women's University. Her background experience in dance includes extensive classical ballet training, expanded by undergraduate and graduate study in various modern dance techniques. Dr. Morris seeks out interdisciplinary opportunities in which her movement expertise can be utilized and expanded. Her collaborative work crosses multiple disciplines, including engineering, physical therapy, architecture, music, and visual art. She enjoys opportunities to utilize dance in diverse and integrative and therapeutic ways. She began exploring the area of integrated and inclusive dance in 2002. Dr. Morris serves on the board for Arts for All Florida, a statewide arts and disability organization. In the Tampa community, Dr. Morris teaches students with and without disabilities for Revolutions Dance and regularly choreographs. I hope you enjoy this episode. It is quite amazing what the things that she has done. So Marilyn, I was reading a lot about your work when preparing for this, and oh my gosh, I mean, I always knew that you're quite amazing, but you've been like a powerhouse.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of things, it seems, yeah.
A lot, like a lot of amazing things too.
Thank
so you're a professor at the University of South Florida, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you've been there for a while now.
And then yeah, I've actually been there 20 years.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Years.
Well, so did you do your PhD between being in there?
I did my PhD concurrent. Like, I started the PhD program in 2012. And it was a distance kind of PhD where you would go in the summer, and it was at Texas Women's University. So you would go in the summer, but then during the year, everything was online.
Okay. Okay.
And it involved 2 years of coursework and 3 years dissertation. So I finished the dissertation work in 2017.
And what was your dissertation work about?
It was dance and disability related very much. It was the actual title was Dance, Disability, and Assistive Technology Design, something along the lines of exploring interdisciplinary landscapes. So I was in the dissertation, I was looking pretty closely at how the field of dance and disability, basically the integrated dance field, changes how we view and think about assistive technology.
Okay.
And therefore, because of the way that lens changes how we think about assistive technology, it also prompts new imaginings, new ideas for the design of assistive technology.
I see.
So that was a way I could fold in my own interest in the design of a different type of wheelchair and kind of lead, basically set the context for how I got to where I got with the design that I ended up moving towards for assistive technology. So it was, you know, it basically pulled from three key areas of study, which was the dance world, the dance studies area, the disability studies area, and then assistive technology and design. So I was looking a lot at design studies, design theories, things that certain kinds of design paradigms that are movement based, like interaction design, you know, user centered design, some universal design kind of paradigm.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Looking at how, you know, those intersected with how we, you know, can often come at things from a dance perspective. So I was looking at, you know, how those things kind of informed each other in useful ways. So.
Well, and what is the chair called? I forgot.
It's called the Rolling Dance Chair.
The Rolling Dance Chair. I love that name.
Well, it seems simple and clear enough, you know, for someone to go, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. It's very descriptive name.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Where are you in the process? Because you actually, do you have more than one piece of those chairs?
I have. So the project actually initiated that project in around 2005.
Okay.
And really kind of got started in 2006 with it. And initially I was collaborating with the engineering department at USF. That was how it initially began.
Okay.
I approached them with the idea and what I was interested in. We proposed a grant. And initially, we started with $20,000. So that's kind of how it began. And in the beginning, there were a lot of students involved. I wasn't like working directly with an engineering faculty member per se. It was mainly me working with a lot of different kinds of students. And it became kind of a student-based project.
Hmm.
So that was wonderful in the beginning as far as just exploring like different exploring the different concepts like the hands-free control, a remote controller, the idea of a height change, how could that be implemented, the idea of a different kind of base structure that would allow omnidirectional movement. So that those were a good way to kind of begin these kind of sparks. But, you know, students graduate, and in many cases, initially, they were undergrad students. So, you know, they didn't also have, like, let's say, the kind of expertise that, you know, a full-fledged, you know, faculty member might have over time. So I ended up, to actually bring the current chair to fruition, I ended up working with engineers outside of USF.
Okay.
One was, I was able to connect with them in a sort of roundabout kind of way. You know, things are, you plan certain things, but it becomes an improvisational experience. So you kind of go with, okay, this is happening now. Let me, you know. So I ended up working with an engineering programmer that's actually in Florida, in Pensacola, Florida. And then I was working with the person who did built the chair and built the sort of mechanical aspects of the chair was actually in California. So a little bit difficult to piece all that together. But so I currently have basically one prototype that embodies the main ideas of the concepts. And I have a second prototype that's actually currently in my garage that needs to be continued to be developed. But I need more funding in order to finish that second prototype, because the second prototype is similar to the first, but it improved on a couple of things. For instance, like the first prototype has a height change possibility to it, but it's a mechanical height change. So you actually have to kind of pump the chair up.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it could be okay, but it's not as useful. So the second prototype here has a powered seat rotation as well as a powered height change.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So the other chair also has seat rotation, so you can change facings. Like if you think about, you know, a office chair, for instance, you know, the ease in which you can change, you know, so the seat moves independent from the base. In the first prototype, that was also mechanical. So you would have there's a little release and then the seat moves freely. But in the second prototype, it's powered. Again, it's controlled via a a motorized controller. So those are just some differences that I think will make things a little easier. Yeah. So at the moment, it's a little, I'm a little bit at a pausing moment, just in terms of funding and seeing what the next steps are, because for a long time, the big push was, well, let's take this existing prototype and see if there might be a company that would be interested in picking up, you know, all of the ideas of it or parts of it and actually producing such a chair. Yes. And so the university, you know, the university owns the patents, but I'm an inventor on the patents as well with other inventors. There's five patents total, five U.S. patents. And so the university was trying also very hard to see if the technology could be licensed to wheelchair companies. And we had some very good interest from top companies like Invacare and like Quantum Mobility as well. And we actually had developed some relationships with them, but ultimately they did not end up licensing the technology. So, you know, ultimately if it's ever going to be, or parts of it are ever going to be produced, it would require a company to take that on.
Of course, yeah, yeah. But it is pretty remarkable when I watched videos of people trying it. I mean, it seems like an amazing idea. Do you feel like the feedback has been from users positive?
Yeah, overarchingly positive. I think from the beginning, most of the people who tried it were particularly appreciative of the omnidirectionality, so the fact that the chair could actually move side to side and moves on diagonal direction. So just that capacity seemed to be useful and helpful and artistically interesting for folks. The whole notion of a hands-free control.
That's the amazing part to me.
You know, I think from just conceptually, I think a lot of people interested in that. The issue becomes exactly how do you want to make the hands-free option come to fruition. So in a very rough draft prototype, initially what was happening was the seat, there were sensors underneath the seat, and when the seat would tilt, the chair would move forward, and when the seat would tilt, it would move back.
Okay.
And so the person was hands-free in that manner. The problem with that was this instability of the seat was not ideal.
Oh, so it could read it with the smallest movements to move forward or backwards or tilt forward.
Yeah, but the seat actually tilted, so that was a little disjunctive. So then the next kind of goal there was to see if we could eliminate the seat tilt altogether and just have pressure sensors and have that subtle pressure shift allow the movement. And that prototype really never got to a fully developed level. So at the same time, I was developing this notion of a wireless controller that then could be worn on the body.
The
idea was, let's have a hands-free controller that could be separate from the chair. So unfix the controller from the chair so that it's not dependent. It's not in some way, you know, a joystick connected to a chair or wheels on a chair, but that it can actually be separated and then worn on the body in some way. So, and that's been kind of the tricky one for different people, because for some people that works pretty well, and for others, again, it's tricky as to where is it placed, how is it secured. But, you know, again, generally good feedback. Dwayne's tried wearing it. Actually, he tried wearing it on his back at one point, which was kind of interesting because he could really kind of navigate, you know, with his back more than we've certainly had people wear it on the chest. I mean, I myself have experimented in the chair wearing it on the chest, and it can feel really organic, you know, in that sense. And I think if that piece could be perfected, it opens up a lot of things. And, you know, the notion of a control that's separate from the person in the chair, with that one, I got sort of a combination of feedback. So one, I think that for some individuals, of course, that's scary, because giving the control to someone else, you know, the control of the chair is, you know, there's a lot of trust there.
Yeah.
So there's issues of agency around that and issues of trust. But at the same time, like for one, well, you, I think you know Tanya Winters.
Yeah, my best friend.
Yeah, Tanya.
Yeah.
So when she tried the chair, you know, it was sort of really interesting to me because she had a very clearly different experience than some of the others, in the sense she got in it, and of course she loves improv.
Yes.
And she's used to improv, and so she got in it, and she was like, "Oh!" I even said to her, "I said, okay, well, I'll direct the chair. How would you like me to direct the chair? You can tell me, or I can just do kind of a pattern of front, back, side, whatever you'd like." And she said, "You know, do whatever. I'll just go with it." And that's what she did. She started kind of floating and around, and she just seemed to love the freedom of kind of allowing, not knowing, in a sense, you know, yeah, letting. Like kind of giving the control to someone else. So I think, and we say giving the control, but really the control is on multiple levels, right? So yeah, just because I have control of where the chair goes spatially, it doesn't mean I have control of other things. I don't have control of actually what her body chooses to do in that chair.
Yeah.
And I don't, and also the user who's in the chair can stop the chair at any time.
Okay.
So they always can stop moving.
Okay.
They can stop the chair from moving. So there's different levels of agency, you know, in when we were talking about, you know, who has the control. But in dance, you know, in contact improv, as you know, there's a constant, that's a constant negotiation of control,
yeah,
you know?
Yes.
We're yielding, we're receiving, we're, so to me, you know, I'll be honest that the whole, I mean, it was really interesting to improvise with this chair, with this remote controller, with multiple people, because, you know, I myself also love contact improvisation, and this was kind of like a remote controlled contact improvisation.
I love that.
It was really interesting because the control person, the person who had the controller in this case, because someone could, another dancer could actually wear it or even hold it and still interact potentially. But in this case, the controller was off at a distance, and he was watching us. And it was as if we were having this distant, you know, he was absolutely intimately still involved with what we were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, but his contact with us was in a different form. It was through this remote form.
Yeah, it sounds like there's definitely a strong relationship still. Like that's a relationship and, you know, starting space and time within that dance improvisation, but in a very different form.
Right. Right. So it's like that person was sort of the invisibly present person. You know, they were still, and it made me think a lot about, from again, like sort of theoretically, conceptually, about our lives, our virtual lives, you know, even you and me right now, you know, we're not actually physically connecting, but we're connecting. And in some degree, the chair technology in that form for me became a little bit of a representation culturally of kind of what's even happening
in our world.
In our world. Yeah.
And not to put words for Tanya's mouth, but just thinking of like that experience with her on the chair, I can see how the pressure of locomoting, taking that away and just enjoying the movement and the motion, like that, I can see that very freeing.
Right. Right. Just like, if someone's lifting you,
exactly.
I mean, you're like, okay, you know, or they have some other control of a part of you for some reason. I mean, there's a freedom in that relinquishment. So I think in the research work for me, this whole notion of what freedom means to people and what control means to people, and how those two are interrelated, how people define freedom for themselves, was sort of fascinating.
Or how this idea of somebody controlling is always negative.
Right.
The first connotation is always negative.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily have that in it even.
Right. 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 And, you know, again,
because you would still, the person in a chair is the one who decides who holds the remote.
Well, yeah. And they could even dictate, they could tell the person, you know, they could say, hey, I want you to circle me. I want you to do this. There's a number of levels that they could still be in control. But you're right about assumptions, because one person that I spoke with who had not had tried the chair, her immediate, it seemed, fear was, oh my God, what a horrible thing that someone could have control of my chair. And until I, you know, I tried to explain, well, they don't actually have full control.
Yeah.
There is a relinquishment of some control, but again, you can stop anytime, and they don't, and again, the issue of the person may have control to some degree of some spatial movement, but they don't have control of what your body chooses to do. I mean, they're not operating your limbs.
Yeah, so, I mean, I even think about the idea of like writing a score and handing it to somebody who holds the...
Right.
You know, like that's actually kind of really interesting idea. But I do get, I mean, as a non-disabled person, I know that control, that is an issue.
Yes.
So maybe you can find a new word for the remote control. You need to call it something totally different.
Right. Something else. Yeah. So, I mean, those are, you know, those are kind of discoveries that have been fun for me, as far as having different people try and then give feedback, and then just, and not even just the verbal feedback, but just me either improvising with them or watching what their bodies do. Like Mark Brew, I was so excited because it was actually exactly what I kind of had envisioned or hoped for. What he did in the chair is something that I had hoped for. And that was, he immediately started, well, not super immediately, but pretty soon, he started reorienting his body in the chair. Because I've always imagined and wished that, again, new spatial orientations could really be possible, and which is what a lot of wheelchair users are doing. I mean, it's what I've done in choreography as well. They're tilting the chair on its side. They're changing the axis. So that's what I was saying, is that people are already doing the thing that is pointing to new technological possibilities.
Yes.
And it's kind of like, in my view, the technology needs to kind of look at that, the designers, and say, oh, how can we better enable that person to do that also healthfully, you know? Yeah. So support what they're trying to do with new bodily orientations. And that's what Mark did, is, you know, he turned himself upside down, put his legs over the top of the chair, you know, and I was circling him, and he didn't actually have the opportunity to wear the controller, and that was unfortunate because it just wasn't calibrating very well, so he couldn't try that. But yeah, he just kept reorienting his body in that chair, and it was really fun to watch.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I can just see endless possibilities with it. It's still ongoing. You're still, like you said, well, you said it's been in a little pause, but.
Right. I mean, as far as the exploration, I can, you know, people can still test the chair. I've had a number of people try it who have different types of disabilities. So that possibility exists, and it's just at a little bit of a pause right now because of the funding. I can't really progress with the second prototype that I have. And, you know, and again, ultimately, the device, the production of the device is limited in the sense that I'm not a production company. So I'm a choreographer, a dancer, and a researcher. so at a certain point, it may just stop with prototypes. I mean, you know, unless, you know, some other situation occurs to actually finesse and find, you know, what it is.
But I just heard today, and now I don't, I might remember the brand of the car wrong, but I think it was BMW who created 5 wheelchairs for the Adaptive Olympics, and they had amazing success with the new wheelchairs. And then they were asked, well, are you going to start building these chairs? And they said, no. And like that's the sort of like mentality that, or the culture that we all wish that would change.
Right.
Like there is a need, and there is a user base, and yeah, I mean, amazing chairs, manual, they were manual chairs, but for athletes, and then they only made those 5, had a huge success, and that was the end of it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you definitely run into this issue of the bottom line, you know, will Medicare pay for it? You know, how many can we make? You know, how many people will it serve? But, you know, I just think you have to keep putting it out there, and because, yeah, the feedback from people is big. And, you know, and again, with those technologies, like many technologies that are useful for people with disabilities, you end up seeing that there's a great deal of usefulness with them in other, you know, in, you know, typically bodied populations as well. And so there may be things that, you know, people don't quite grasp right now, but things from the development of those wheelchairs that actually could be useful for, you know, general population. And that's, I think, where designers have to keep their minds open and not kind of, you know, okay, well, we can't make enough money. It's just going to be for this population. You know, it's a limited view. So yeah, I would love to see a whole line of, you know, different types of dance assistive devices, you know, that have different capacities.
Absolutely. I'm trying to look at the name of the woman who's, who I was listening today about her. I actually heard her creative morning talk as well. It was really quite inspiring. I hate the word. Sorry, I used it. But her name is Liz Jackson, who talked about it. So I will. And she has a company in New York City that she's pushing people with disabilities to get involved in like design.
Great. So that's great. Yeah, important.
How did you end up working in the dance and disability field?
Well, that started in about 2000, the year 2000, and it really kind of came from two sources. One was my life. My family life has certainly been touched by disability because I grew up for a large part of my life was with my father, who was disabled.
Okay.
So when I was 12 years old, my father was injured in a severe car accident where two people crossed the center line and hit him head on in a head on car collision. And he almost died. He was in a coma for about a month. And when he came out of the coma, he had a lot of brain damage and therefore physical complications. He had a seizure disorder. And at first, the first year after the accident, he actually could still walk. But after the first seizure happened, it changed. He developed some different issues of paralysis.
Okay.
The paralysis would kind of come and go, but he used wheelchairs. And so, honestly, my life was kind of filled with a lifestyle of being around and being part of the disability, you know, world in that sense, in a very, you know, basic personal way. And also I was an only child, so it was kind of just my mom and I figuring out, you know, this new person and his new needs. And we didn't have any kind of roadmap. And we tried, you know, my mom was a visual artist, so we tried to be creative in all the things we did. My mom is highly creative, so she was always doing, you know, getting things off the internet and getting, you know, things to help his body sit up better in the chair and help with circulation. He had circulatory issues. And, you know, we just found in, you know, and of course we had some very basic kind of like a manual chair, a basic Everest and Jennings chair, because that's what was provided to us, you know, and then we got some other chairs, but the chairs were all often limiting, you know, just honestly that they were helpful at a level, but there were also things that were not helpful. And that involved circulation. You know, they did not help promote circulation. And also, you know, to some extent, the way that they kind of boxed in my dad, you know, the access to him changed.
Oh yeah.
And you know, and one of the things that I kind of talk about is the issue that when you have a disability, sometimes the focus becomes very narrowly focused on the individual using an apparatus, you know, and just their needs, versus thinking about this as a community experience, in the sense that this person's connected to their mother, this person's connected to their children. Mm-hmm. How do their children, how do their family, how does everyone continue their relationship with and through the device or the apparatus, as well as through the disability? But for my dad, it was partly about, well, how do I now interact literally through this device, you know, because I mean, I had a very physical relationship with my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, I would jump on him, play on him, and he was like a jungle gym to me.
Yeah.
You know, so that aspect of our relationship changed significantly because I just didn't know, you know, I didn't know how to sort of do that anymore. And I think that dance, again, is such integrated dance is such a beautiful thing because we're bringing people back to an understanding of how to do that. How do you reintegrate the relationship, you know? Because otherwise people don't know what to do or what I do with this thing. And so I think that my whole life kind of certainly informed, you know, ideas about, you know, assistive devices and disability. And the accident also happened before the ADA was in place, the Americans with Disabilities Act. So we ran into some barriers and things, you know, that are better now and have improved now. But we certainly, as a family, experienced, you know, discriminatory, facial expressions and all kinds of things from people. And, you know, my mom, I think, always felt like she had to kind of take up for my dad and kind of remind people that he was still a human being, you know. I mean, so I will say that the disability experience, because we were so connected to him, almost became like we experienced it too. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, as a family unit, you did.
Yeah. We felt that kind of pressure and just, you know, the staring and all that. And then our feeling of like trying to like, you know, no, he's a normal person, you know, fine. Don't make that judgment about this. You know, he's my dad, you know, so those kinds of things. And then the second thing that really informed it is my life in dance and as a choreographer. And then in around 2000, I started working with dancers with disabilities. And that came about because actually I went to a performance of Dancing Wheels.
Okay.
They had performed here in Tampa, and it was the first time I had seen a professional dance company with dancers with disabilities in my whole dance life. The first time I had been exposed visually to that.
Wow.
And I thought it was wonderful and terrific and excellent and exactly what we should be doing, you know, exactly what we should be doing in dance in terms of pushing our artistic innovation and pushing inclusion. So for me, I just resonated right away, and I thought, can I be involved, you know, in some way with this? And so there was a flyer there at their performance of someone local who was doing some classes, some integrated dance classes. And so I emailed her, and I also knew that we probably had, some USF students who might be interested in this work. So I thought this would be a great resource for them as well. So that's how it started. And then because of that, that's basically how I met Dwayne.
Okay.
And that Dwayne and I started working together at about that time, 2001 to 2002. And so he was really my the first time I worked explicitly with someone with a disability in terms of dance, in terms of choreography. So and I was really his first kind of exposure to really working with, you know, a choreographer. And so it's been a really interesting journey, you know, both his and mine in different, you know, kinds of ways. And so it just kind of, you know, kept evolving from there. And at one point when Dwayne kind of developed Revolution's Dance, at one point there were like 5 wheelchair dancers that were, you know, really interested and engaged with us. And we, you know, had a lot of wonderful explorations together. But then as things go, you know, one decided he really was interested in ballroom dance. So he kind of went just the ballroom dance direction. And then another one moved away. Another dancer moved away. And then another one, unfortunately, she had MS, and she ended up going into a nursing home very early in her life because of visual impairment and some other more severe things. So that, you know, kind of changed. And so sort of like Dwayne's been the main, you know, our relationship has been the sustaining factor over time. But yeah, so that's how it started, and I love it. And then I started working with the student program in Revolution's Dance around 2013-ish, 2013, 2014, something like that. And so I've been now working with the students since then.
And you teach the weekly classes, right?
Yeah, teach the weekly classes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is just amazing. And do I remember correct that Dwayne was saying that you are building a certificate program at the university now?
Well, I wanted to. I still would like to. My only barrier to that is honestly, my teaching load is full right now.
I bet.
And I would have to actually create, or I would want to create, one or two like new courses. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of thinking of like a kind of a seminar course, a dance and disability seminar course. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, I'd like to have, you know, a specific like integrated dance course. And right now I can't, I don't have room to create those courses and teach them or even co-teach them. So I've thought, well, on the other hand, what I can do is continue to be an advocate, continue to do my own research and do the community work. And also I started this, you know, new definition of dance event.
Yes. When? That was in
2015.
Okay. 3 years ago.
So this is now our third year that we're doing it, and hopefully it's a sustainable thing. I'm collaborating with VSA Florida, which is now Arts to All Florida.
Oh, yeah, because all the VSAs are...
Yes.
Disassociating from the Kennedy Center.
So we're now Arts to All Florida, and of course, they're headquartered at USF, so we have a lot of partnerships together.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I didn't realize that they are in your university.
They're absolutely headquartered. So the possibility of doing some kind of dance and disability curriculum and at the very least doing events and advocacy is absolutely there and will continue. So I'm hoping that that event will be a sustainable event that we can continue, because my goal was to bring dancers with disabilities and put them in front of our students as teachers.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Not just come and perform, but actually put them in front, just like any guest artist would do to teach a dance class. Because again, what I feel was missing from my dance education overall was that exposure.
Yes.
You know, and in terms of my undergraduate work and any of my early work, obviously life in classical ballet and all of this, I mean, no one talked about dancers with disabilities and I never saw them. So it was like an invisible population.
Yeah.
So I feel like what I can do as an educator is make those spaces for the visibility, bring the visibility.
Absolutely. There. Yeah. That's a lot. That's a huge already, because like you said, it has been not there at all.
Yeah.
And do you feel your university is actually quite welcoming for this, or have you had a lot of pushback?
No, I think at this point they're pretty welcoming. I think the culture at large is supportive of, you know, diversity, and disability is obviously part of the diversity discussion. So, and honestly, with the wheelchair project from the beginning was very supported by the upper administration. They, you know, they really saw that it was pretty cutting edge, and they really thought it was, you know, pretty interesting. It was not as supported, like to some extent internally, more in the department, or not as much supported as I would say understood.
Okay. Yeah.
Or like that the value, that it was valued in the same way. Now, you know, flash forward, you know, however many years, I think over time, you know, more education has happened, more awareness of actually open. So in our dance program now, I sense and feel a lot of support from the full faculty as far as the dance and disability work at large. In fact, one of our faculty just recently, he just did the Dance for PD program.
Oh,
dance
yeah, for okay, yeah.
New York. And, you know, I think we do have a really nice culture that's very open and inviting to possibilities. And if, you know, if there was another faculty member or another, even across, because I know someone who teaches a disability and society course, and I was gonna embed her course like in the certificate to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And I had already spoken with her about that, and she was interested in that. So if there was some way of doing it in a simpler manner, that I wouldn't have to take on like two new courses.
Yeah.
That's, you know, because I love curricular development, and I really think it's important, and I would love to be able to create something like that. But maybe, you know, maybe it could be like a workshop model or something, where it's like a series of workshops that we offer instead of a full length, you know, semester course. Maybe it's just a different way of envisioning the structure, you know.
I have a great idea. I'll come as a master's student to your university and I'll do it with you.
Okay. Okay. That sounds great. That's terrific.
Yeah, I've been wanting to go back to school for a very long time.
Yeah.
But I really don't know. Like, I would love to study dance and disability, but there's nowhere to go. Or I would need to do it from the very get-go myself.
Right.
Which is probably what I would just end up doing. But so I was super excited when Dwayne was talking about that, because I was like, yeah, I could do that. So I, hands down.
Well, two things I have done from a curricular perspective that have been useful. One is we have a dance pedagogy class for our undergraduate students, because we only have an undergraduate program. It's, we don't have a grad program at USF, actually. But within the undergrad program, there's a dance pedagogy class, and they've never covered inclusive teaching. So I went to the pedagogy teacher and I said, hey, I'd love to come in and do a lecture on inclusive teaching. And again, not that I imagine myself to be, you know, the I can cover all of the greatest, but, you know, you have to start somewhere.
Exactly.
So now I'm coming into the pedagogy class, and now there's a part of their classes. So they are, the students are getting that little piece, at least.
That's wonderful.
Of something. And then the other part that I've been able to add into the curriculum is we have a class called Understanding the Dance Experience. And it's an online class where it's like the whole potpourri of, you know, learn a little bit of jazz history, you know, learn a little bit of ballet history, a little modern, postmodern, you know, hip hop. It's like throw it all together. And but from a cultural and social perspective. So they're really looking at how dance is a meaning making activity within a cultural and social context.
Wow.
And so I was able to embed a disability section in there, a dance and disability section in with the kind of the postmodern, because that's around the same timing, and put it in there. So I feel like there's a little ways of getting the education in there.
I think that's huge. I think that's more than I heard. Now when doing this research, I heard a lot of I heard from two different places that are really, I feel like, going fast forward with their dance and disability courses or programs. But this is really, I think this is amazing. This is exactly what we should do, is to not, you know, start from somewhere, start embedding these.
Right.
How to watch this dance field and how actually wide and varied and diverse it is.
Right.
So I think that's amazing. That's really great.
Right. So maybe, you know, maybe the idea of just taking, looking at the existing curricula, looking at the dance history courses, looking at, you know, choreography, and just finding ways to insert, you know, those moments of, you know, okay, well, now let's watch this piece from, you know, this integrated dance company, you know. And then, you know, I think, you know, maybe things can kind of evolve from there.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. I mean, I think it's just so important. I think it's so important, and I think it's, it's socially and culturally important. But I think that, I imagine you feel this way too, that the disability field pushes dance in the most radical and interesting ways artistically.
Oh yes.
You know, and that in that sense, like it's such a creative force, you know, and that's the piece that sometimes people don't see, you know, that they see it as, you know, oh, well, that's a good, you know, sort of social justice thing to do in terms of diversity, you know, and it is, but there's this whole other element about if we're trying to educate dancers of how to be truly creative artists, you know, and to push the creative rigor, how showing them these very different bodies and very different, you know, working with apparatus and different things and mobility devices in different ways, how that pushes them so much differently outside of their box. And I think, I mean, you know, being trained as a ballet dancer, you know, there were these, you know, peak elements of perfection, you know, that, you know, you had to attain, you know, and, you know, even for myself, because I remember, you know, and even still, and, you know, I think, oh God, if I get injured, you know, I just can't do such and such. And that's kind of the mentality that a lot of our dancers have. And there's this huge fear there, but they really feel like, oh my gosh, if I hurt my little finger, that's the end of my dance, or if I hurt my little toe, that's it. That's all. That's the end of my passion. That's the end of my artistry. And so then we also have this incredible model of a field, an integrated dance field, that's like, look, you know, here's a person with no legs and they're dancing and they're beautiful, you know, and they're doing, you know, incredible things here. And there's
and
a lot.
And they are contributing to the field right. As an artist.
Right, right, exactly. And so I think there's just this other element about injury prevention and health and how we think about training, and that the dance and disability field really makes us rethink our traditional approaches. I think it's so healthy.
Agreed.
For us, you know, because and there's aging, and you know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like it's the same thing. Like I think about our faculty, like who's dancing, who's not. Well, you know, a lot of times, I don't know, you know, if you did a survey of university dance faculties, but a lot of times it seems like the modern dance faculty will kind of keep, you know, dancing at a level, you know, in their classes, et cetera, to, you know, so it's into the longer ages. But the ballet faculty don't. And, you know, sometimes it makes me wonder, like, because I see them, though, they have beautifully still trained bodies and, you know, physicalities and artistry inside of them. And so, yeah, so it just makes me think, you know, sometimes why do we limit ourselves in these sort of, you know, okay, well, that's an aging body and no one wants to see an aging body on stage, and that's a disabled body. Okay, that person has an injury, so we don't, that person can't do that. I just think it makes us rethink a lot of things.
And I think it also narrows our field in a way of like who can consume dance as a hobby and as an audience member. If we put these like boxes that these are the only people who can dance, because
right.
then you also put the box around who can really come and watch.
Right, right.
Who is
right.
this
yeah,
for?
Mm-hmm. Right, right, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I could talk to you forever.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking, oh my gosh, my brain's like sparking in these
it
different.
It is so places. Good. Is that a VSA or
Arts for All Florida?
And your festival happening this year as well.
It is. Mm-hmm.
When is it?
It is November 1st and 2nd.
Okay, great.
We're bringing in Luca. Do you know Luca Patuelli?
Yeah, yeah.
Canada, Luca Lazy Lace Patuelli. So we're bringing in his company this time.
That's the Ill-ability. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're coming in, and they're going to be doing some workshops at U.S. They're teaching two classes for our dance majors, and then they're doing workshops in the community, and then the performance is actually Friday, November 2nd at 7:30.
Okay.
They're doing an hour-long performance, and then there's a reception afterwards. And then they're actually traveling to three different cities. So, because VSA is statewide,
yeah.
what we've been trying to do is when we have this festival, again, try to spread the visibility so that it doesn't just happen in Tampa, but that it actually, they go to Miami and also Jacksonville.
Okay.
So, and, you know, could possibly travel other places. But with New Definition of Dance, one of my interests was not only trying to bring professional artists, with disabilities, but also to bring them potentially from different dance genres.
Yes, that is really important.
Because, so that's what, with Luca, I like, is that he is in this different genre. He's in the breakdance genre, and that, you know, a lot of integrated dance has kind of been cultivated and risen up and is promoted within more of the modern dance.
Yes.
Arena.
Yeah.
And I just think that if we're going to support the community at large, you know, we need to recognize those in other dance genres who are also doing things that have artistic rigor and have performance rigor, you know, not like, you know, just a little class that someone takes because, you know, it's more like a therapy class, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's a lovely thing, and I'm supportive of that too. But if we are trying to celebrate and celebrate, again, performance, some kind of performance rigor, artistic rigor, then I think, you know, we need to look at different, you know, all the different genres. And that's, I also brought Hanna Harchakova, who's a wheelchair ballroom dance champion.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the New Definition of Dance last year and the year before, or rather 2015 and 2016, I brought her and her partner. And, you know, that's ballroom. And I know sometimes, you know, there can be kind of a separation because the sort of the aura or the goals of ballroom dance sometimes feel different than the, let's say, the communicative intent or the, you know, modern dance kind of, you know, envisions itself to be in terms of its, you know, meaningful communicative intent. But really, it's just, it's, you have to look at, there's different kinds of communication too. And Hannah brought, she's a beautiful performer. I mean, she's just dynamic, you know, she's just her body is, you know, she's so engaged. And, so yeah, that's just the genre she works in. In fact, I kept wishing, I was like, oh, I would love to choreograph something with her, you know? I think she would be very open to that. You know, it just happens to be that she's gravitated towards ballroom, but you know, she's got a lovely sensibility in her body as far as movement qualities. And so it was nice to be able to, and it was important too, for other artists to meet each other.
Yes.
You know, who maybe wouldn't normally meet to actually cross paths and, you know, maybe create their own festivals or, you know, collaborations or exchanges.